Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest edition of The Ranking, which is the special Empire podcast in which we rank, yes, rank, I said rank, the filmography of a director or a writer or an actor or a franchise. And in this case, we've gone for our first ever franchise and it is the famous Space Wars.
No. Space travel.
Space travel.
Space journey.
Space wagon. Space wagon.
Close, actually.
Star Trek. Yeah. Yes, it is indeed Star Trek. And over the next hour or so, we are going to be rating the Star Trek movies and then coming up with a definitive order for them. That's very, very exciting. And I am joined by three Trekkeroonies. I am joined by Helen O'Hara.
Hello. I'm not sure that's the word.
That is the word. That's the official word, Helen. Dan Jolin.
Hello. I'm doing that thing.
Oh, right.
I'm holding up my hand.
You're holding a fee for Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, which is your favourite one. Is that what it is?
Don't. Honestly, I will jump across this table and rip your heart out.
And we would all tell you it was justifiable homicide.
Yes.
That's the old Falcon procedure, isn't it? And we're joined, of course, by James Dyer, who has patronised more people about Star Trek movies than you've had hot... Romulan ale.
Kerplach.
It was Kerplunk.
And I will say that what you just did was an attempt at Klingon, even though you called it Vulcan because you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was upsetting.
I realized as I was doing it, it sounded like Klingon, but you know, it's fine. What does Vulcan sound like?
It sounds a lot like English because they translate it with a universal translator.
And don't they translate Klingon with a universal translator?
Only when plot convenience requires it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you ready to patronise me for the next 45 minutes or so?
Ready and willing and able.
Because that's established some credentials here. James, you are... the official word is Trekker, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I go with Trekkie. I'm old school.
You prefer Trekkie?
I don't need to be patronised. I'm more than happy to embrace the fact that it's massively nerdy.
Okay. Good. Dan, but you've seen all the films.
I have seen all things Trek ever made ever.
Dan, what are your credentials? Establish your Star Trek credentials right now.
Well, Star Trek's been part of my life for all my life. You know, I saw the original series as a child growing up. Star Trek the Motion Picture was the second film I ever saw at the cinema. And maybe more on this later, but I did fall asleep. I was five. And then as a teenager, The Next Generation came along and I loved it and watched the whole thing. And then, I've seen all the movies and at least half of them.
Yeah, okay. We'll get on to that in a second. And Helen?
Similar. I haven't seen every single thing because I haven't seen all of the animated series.
And that's true, neither have I. Yeah, you got me there.
And I actually missed a couple of the later seasons of Enterprise, which at some point I might go see. But
kind of forgivable.
You know.
Yeah.
But yes, I'm a big Trek fan and like Dan, probably about half the films. But there is that interesting thing with Trek films, isn't there?
Yeah.
So the rule for the original sort of crew was even numbers good, odd numbers pretty bad, or at least weaker. And then that's slightly been reversed maybe in the J.J. Abrams era.
That's an accurate assessment. I would say that the best odd-numbered film for me is 3.
Yeah,
this
is correct.
For Spock, which I believe James does not care for.
It's not the best odd-numbered film, but it's fine.
What's the best odd-numbered film? Are we talking J.J. Abrams?
Generations?
No. 7, 9.
7, 9. You're
11.
You're just making up numbers now. These aren't even real films.
No, 11 is the best odd-numbered one. But
I think the whole odd-even thing got thrown out when the Next Generation films came along, didn't it?
Yeah, that's why I said original.
Yes, and no.
Because 7's the first next-gen film, which I'm sure we'll get onto, is flawed. And 9, which I love, is heavily flawed.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely unfair.
But we have hit upon something that I discovered actually when I was putting together my top 10. So how the ranking works is that we each put together our individual top 10 and then I assign a point system to each one. So number one gets 10 points, number 10 gets 1 point and so on. And then we figure it out and I go away and run it through a little calculator. Bloop, 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 bloop. And then we come back with a definitive Empire top 10. So that's what we're going to do right at the end of the podcast. So we're going to be going through that in the top 10. But when I was going through my top 10, I struggled. Because I think there are about... and again, James will disagree here, but, you know, that's what he does. He picks hills to die on. There are about, I'd say, at a stretch, 7 objectively good Star Trek films. And then after that, you have just varying degrees of shitness all the way down to the final frontier?
I think I had 8 ones that I was happy to put in a top 10.
Okay.
And then the other two were very, they were fine. And I think that's what's interesting. So the two I put in at the bottom of my top 10 were next generation films, which I think are fine. But they didn't. But they didn't upset me as much as the really bad original series ones or the really bad J.J. Abrams one, both of which, all of which made me actively angry. So these ones didn't make me angry. I just didn't love them.
The problem you've got with this as a franchise is that you can think of episodes from the TV shows which are stronger than the movies. I mean, I'm terrible at remembering the titles of any of the episodes, so I couldn't say, well, this episode or that episode, but some of the Next Generation episodes, you know, or the two-parters even, which, you know, at the time up is equivalent of a movie, were so much better than, say, for example, Insurrection or something like that. So, and recently Discovery, I thought was absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So in my head at the moment, the best thing in Star Trek is Star Trek Discovery, and it's you can't separate the films out from that. So they're kind of, it's in doing this list, I was kind of wishing I could put all that episode where in instead of a film. But then we would have ended up with...
Then we'd actually have a discussion about number one, because I suspect we all agree largely on what number one is.
I think you might be surprised.
Really?
I think you might be surprised.
Okay, we've got some contrarians in the room, fine. Mm. But the point being, I think Best of Both Worlds would suddenly be in the mix. At least Best of Both Worlds Part 1 would be right up there.
In fact, let's talk about it now. Let's talk about what I think would be most people's undisputed champ of Star Trek. And for me, this is the undisputed champ of all Star Trek, the best of both worlds. If we were to allow that, and we allowed TV for the Stephen King ranking a couple of months ago, but I think it would get a bit complicated if we suddenly allowed it for Star Trek. For me, it's Wrath of Khan. And Wrath of Khan is just the best Star Trek film, isn't it, by a country mile?
It's blinding. It's got a great piece of horror in it, you know, with the worm thing in Chekhov's ear, which is giving nightmares as a kid.
A literal earworm.
It's got those great naval battle scenes, which for me are right up there with Master and Commander and Hunt for Red October. It has high stakes like no other Trek film, I think, and it has that emotional whammy that I still cannot talk about without tearing up. I cannot. It is so well done.
You're talking about the death of Scotty's young nephew.
I'm just not okay with it.
We didn't know that was his nephew, though, unless we were watching it on telly.
What, really?
Yeah, that was the weird thing, because the theatrical release of Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, didn't have that scene where it's revealed that that's Scotty's nephew. It was only when they showed it on telly, they showed a longer version.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So if you go back, if you remember that scene and you actually went back now on watching on DVD or something, they wouldn't be there.
Holy shit. Dan dropping the knowledge bombs. The knowledge photon torpedoes have been fired. Amazing, Dan. You've enlightened me. But yeah, that's a big moment. That's a big emotional moment. There's nothing else in that film.
No, nothing else.
But that film is so great for a whole bunch of reasons. And we'll get on to that moment as well later on. But it's so good as well about friendship.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best representation for me of that Holy Trinity in the original Star Trek movies. So obviously I'm talking about Uhura, Worf and Chekhov. They're just together at long last. I'm kidding, of course. Bones, Kirk and Spock. It's the best representation of that friendship for me.
Uhura.
What?
It's Uhura, not
I
Uhura.
I don't care. Just Why saying. Do I care?
What, about I getting the name care. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's up to you. You want to say on the podcast? Do everyone.
I thought it was O'Hara.
Yeah, what's that?
Yes,
too?
It is, yes.
Welcome to the podcast, please. Helen Uhura. No one says it like that in the Star Trek movies.
Except everyone in Star Trek movies.
Nobody does.
Yeah, that's her name.
Anyway.
It's such a really rich sketching of that, of aging as well.
Yes, and I think the reason that it works and that a film like Star Trek Into Darkness is complete tripe is that it has the weight of 30 years of friendship behind it. And even if you never watched the original series, because I hadn't watched most of the original series when I saw that film, but you feel that long sense of camaraderie between them. You feel that they don't always agree, but they respect each other's respective strengths. And it has the ring of truth to it, I think, because there is an element of truth there that I think they'd had their disagreements over the years, they'd had their fallings out over the years, but by that point they were, you know, a little bit more on solid ground, and they felt a little bit more for each other, and it kind of comes across on screen.
I think I sense the undercurrent of hostility towards Into Darkness seeping into this particular...
Dude, I'm still angry.
I, in defense of Into Darkness, it is not a great film, but it's not a bad film. I think a lot of the animosity towards it comes from the fact that it tries to surf the Wrath of Khan's yes. wave. And there's an insult to that. There's a how dare they, you haven't earned this to
yes.
that. And I think all of that is valid. But I think I try and set that aside and kind of love it for what it is. You know, sort of mongrel dog stray thing that's wandered in off the streets. But, you know, it's still cute. It's still fluffy. You can still stroke it.
There are good bits in it. And I do think that cast is also an extremely good cast. Mm. But I can't get over the insult. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I do remember at the time quite enjoying it, but I haven't been tempted to revisit it at any point since. And yeah, it pitches into, because the first Abrams Trek is, I think, legitimately great. It has plot yes. holes the size of
really
imploding planet.
Mine possibly Olympics, the biggest in the entire cinematic series,
which is
the timeline stuff doesn't make any sense. Like, what has Nero been doing? I mean, honestly, if you start thinking about it, you start wanting
it.
To I'm sure there was
if you have to produce a comic to explain the plot hole in your film.
He was mining for the Klingons.
There are deleted Klingons, scenes from that I believe as well, which never made it.
It's pining for the fjords.
Oh, dear.
So the first Trek is great. One of my best cinematic experiences was watching at the Royal Albert Hall a few years ago. Did you guys go to that? The one of those things where they have the live orchestra playing the soundtrack. So it was Abrams Star Trek with Michael Giacchino there, just looking on. Someone else did the conducting, and J.J. Abrams and Simon Pegg came on to do an introduction. And it was just glorious. That Giacchino score for that movie is
so
wonderful.
Yeah. Those timpani are just amazing.
Oh, I love the timpani.
It's no Wrath of Khan score though.
The Wrath of Khan score is
that's a high point, that is.
Wrath of Khan score is like that close to Aliens, isn't it?
It is,
it's
yeah.
like, it's just sort of like, yeah. just a little bit to the left, it's Aliens.
It's very string heavy.
Yeah. I mean, just to jump back, because I'm slightly worried that we're going to get sidetracked from talking about how good Wrath of Khan is and just getting into a kicking into darkness, which it does deserve, because Helen's right, it is shit.
Oh.
But something to pick up something Helen said, which was the naval battle, effectively. Mm. And what I love about Wrath of Khan is that we were so used to space battles being dogfights because of Star Wars. Whereas what Wrath of Khan did was it reminded us that, I mean, not that I'm an expert on interstellar combat or whatever, but that it would be more like naval warfare, that makes sense, except in three dimensions. And I think Wrath of Khan just sold that perfectly. And I really love the fact that it's slow and careful and considered, and the way that the tactics have to be thought out as you're anticipating the moves, a few moves ahead and everything. And, you know, I just thought that was superb.
Yeah, and again, it reflects the series better, I think, than any dogfight would. Yeah.
But the entire film is nautical, isn't it? Because it's essentially a retreading of Moby Dick. That sort of runs very deeply in its veins.
But the whole thing was a response in a way, wasn't it? It was a course correction. It was a righting of the ship after the motion picture has certainly put Star Trek.
They changed tack.
It had put it back in the map, but not in a great way. And this felt more like an attempt to make a rip-roaring adventure.
Yeah, I mean, is anyone going to go to bat for the motion picture?
No one. No one can go to bat for that.
apart from anything else, just the look of it was wrong. I mean, those horrendous flesh-coloured uniforms are one of the worst decisions, I think, in costuming history. And there are, I think, some good bits about it, and it has some big sci-fi concepts.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so messy overall that
and Robert Wise directed it. I do wonder sometimes if it suffered from that very early example of what can happen sometimes with a comic book movie when you have a director who doesn't necessarily have a connection to the source material, or maybe thinks are a little bit above the source material and maybe tries to outthink it and over intellectualize it, and sometimes that can result in brilliance. You can have a Dark Knight, and sometimes it can result in Ang Lee's Hulk, which is flawed, sometimes brilliant. I quite like it, but at the same time, it does have at the end Eric Bana and Nick Nolte screaming at each other like some terrible off Broadway play. And I wonder if maybe Robert Wise did that a little bit. You know, here's the great director of West Side Story and and so maybe he has to elevate it in some way. I don't really know, but that's just my feeling. And also it's post Star Wars, and it feels so leaden and pedestrian post Star Wars.
It's funny because of course it was like Star Wars and Close Encounters, because originally, so they talked first of all about a movie in 1975, and then they were like, oh wait, no, let's just do a new series, and then it was Star Wars and Close Encounters, and they were like, oh no, hang on, time is right, let's do this. But it feels a lot more of a reaction to 2001 A Space Odyssey than any other film. In fact, Trumbull came on board because they were having problems with the effects, and they basically got Trumbull in and went, help us, we've only got a few months to release. So it kind of like, it has that feel to it, but it doesn't fit.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't feel like a Star Trek film.
No.
And actually, to the franchise's credit, the others generally do. Even if they have problems, they generally feel like Star Trek films.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not true of every franchise, so fair play, yeah, I guess, in that sense.
Jimbo, what's your take on the motion picture?
I think it's dreadful. I don't know what Star Trek Phase 2 would have been if it had gone ahead. And I know that they, as Dan said, they kind of readjusted this to become, it had been a movie, then it was a show, then it was a movie. But I think it existing in the way it does owes more to Close Encounters than it does to Star Wars. But it's a mess. They sideline important characters, they introduce ridiculous new ones. The whole Voyager idea isn't particularly profound, even though they seem to think it is. But more than anything else, it's just very, very boring. And I think the worst, when Star Trek is at its absolute worst, it's just fucking tedious. And I think this is the most egregious offender in that area. I mean, the other bad films, I'm looking specifically at number 5, are also very, very boring, but at least that has Spock in jet boots. Do you know what I mean? This doesn't even have that. It has nothing going for it.
That is the only good scene in
Yeah, front. Literally the only good thing.
Oh no, that's Scotty banging his head. I know the ship like the back of my hand, and then bang, smacks his head.
No, the bit where they've got to distract the guards. So Uhura puts on a sexy outfit.
It's O'Hara.
Sorry. Helen puts on a... No. Uhura puts on a sexy outfit, stands on top of a sand dune or something, and she does a dance, like a sexy dance.
Yeah.
And all the guards go, ooh, ooh, sexy lady, and all run off. And then they just walk in through the front doors. That's the best scene in The Final Frontier.
Yeah. That's how you distract guards, though. It's true.
Yeah, that's...
You've got to use what you've got, right? Okay, and if you've got a 70-year-old woman, a 70-year-old attractive woman, get her to do a sexy dance, it will always work.
To be honest, Uhura never needed to put on a sexy outfit to be sexy. She's a goddess.
I spoke to Shatner about 5, obviously, which he directed, and he is... I don't know if the word is unrepentant, but certainly he feels a little bit like budgetary constraints stopped it from being what he wanted it to be.
Did he write a book afterwards going, I did it?
Yeah.
I didn't do it, but if I had,
it would have been this. It's bad. I mean, it's the second worst, isn't it? Or the worst, depending on your day. I mean, I think 1 and 5 are interchangeable for the bottom spot in terms of all Trek films.
Yeah, they're pretty. Yeah,
I mean, I'd be hard pressed to pick one over the other.
Well, this goes back to my thing again about, you know, never mind even numbers and odd numbers. I mean, you can also split the Star Trek movies into 3 distinct sets. Of course, the original series, which went up to 6.5, you could say, and then the next gen movies which ran for 4, and then of course the reboot, which seems to have stopped at 3. And I hope it doesn't, because I quite enjoy this reboot cast, and I really hope that they get this, the fourth one, off the ground.
Can I correct you, Chris?
Yes.
It's not a reboot.
Oh, for the love of God.
It's an alternate timeline.
Yeah, it's actually a continuation.
I wonder if the heart went out of them slightly with the death of Anton Yelchin, because he had so much heart in those films, and I feel like that might be part of the reason they feel stalled. There's no way to replace him. And just losing Chekhov means you'd lose something, I think, in that group.
I don't think you'd lose that much. I think he was very good, but I don't think Chekhov is an essential member of
the
crew.
He's not a big cast member.
Yeah.
But I think... I was thinking about this morning, again, in relation to Wrath of Khan, actually, but he's... His sort of sense of enthusiasm and innocence and being younger than the rest, which was always kind of his thing, even into his 60s, is important somehow. It's just that little bit of extra, I don't know, youthful energy that, I mean, they tried to replace with Will Wheaton. Do you know what I mean? They went to a 13-year-old to try and find the same thing. And so I feel like I don't know why you need that, but it feels like it does matter. I don't know.
I wonder if it's a little bit more... cold than that. I think it's just about money. Box office performance. Yeah. I think Star Trek Beyond, although I really, really like it, and I think it does a lot of things right, didn't pull up any trees at the box office worldwide. And so I think the plans for a fourth one, which, as we know, had been semi-announced and would have involved Chris Hemsworth coming back as George Kirk and some sort of time travel malarkey. And that sounds really fun, and it sounds like a really, really nice solution. How do we bump up the box office for this? Oh, we'll stick Thor in it. Obviously not as Thor. That would be weird. But that would have worked for me.
I mean, I think the thing that works for me with the Trek films is when they play on the continuity, when they play on the connections, right? I mean, 2, 3, and 4 are a trilogy. Mm-hmm. They kind of sit together. They're almost continuous, I think, if I remember correctly.
They're
very close together timeline-wise. And it works really well. It's why you can forgive The Search for Spock for its flaws, because actually it's the middle part of two fun films.
Yes.
What was really nice about the JJ not reboot, the establishment of the Kelvin timeline, which is actually number 3 on my list. Am I allowed to say that at this point?
Fuck it.
Is that it actually, it follows the continuity.
Yeah.
It fits in with the whole, you know, even though it creates its own continuum, it fits in because it plays into things. And my number 1 film, which isn't The Wrath of Khan...
Weirdo.
What?
Weirdo.
Which isn't The Wrath of Khan, is one of the reasons it beat The Wrath of Khan, and we can come to it later, is because it fits so nicely within the overall continuity of the entire franchise. Matter of fact, connecting up to, effectively.
Oh, what is it?
The Undiscovered Country.
Oh, okay. Mm.
So Undiscovered Country was very nearly my top choice as well.
Mm, that's number 2 for me.
Mm. What is it about Undiscovered Country, which is a film I've seen maybe twice. I liked it a lot, and I didn't see, and I don't remember now what it is.
Well,
that's
all of the Undiscovered Country's appeal can be distilled into one shot where an airborne Kirk flies across the screen and tackles... what's his name? Is it Kurtwood Smith?
Kurtwood Smith.
Flies across the screen and tackles Kurtwood Smith.
Does he yell?
Saving him.
Does he yell, "Bitches, leave"?
He does not. Okay. Saving him from a sniper's bullet.
Amazing.
And that is one of the greatest moments in cinema.
Is that it?
It's fantastic. Christopher Plummer is amazing as General Chang. It's got such a great guest cast in this one. And the Klingon stuff is fantastic.
The Klingon stuff, that was the thing with the original series films that were about Klingons, which is weird because they're not the only or the best baddie necessarily in the series, but they are the best baddie, I think, by far in the films. And they work because they raise the films to a sort of Shakespearean level, literally in The Wrath of Khan and The Undiscovered Country. Mm-hmm. They lean into that big, broad drama that gives you the sense of scope without losing a sense of intelligence. Because I think Star Trek films have to be intelligent as well as being space adventures. Mm. They can't just be adventure stories. There has to be something more. Which is why, you know, Chris Pine is very good casting Zachary Quinto, because they're smart guys, which is why Shatner and Nimoy work, because they are smart men. You have to have that intellectual edge as well as the derring do and the punching and the green ladies.
This one follows on as well, because obviously it's the death of his son, which is the catalyst for this, because he's kind of hoisted by his own petard in terms of his prejudice against Klingons.
Picard.
Hoist by his own Picard. When he's sentenced to the penal asteroid of Rurapente, the ice planet.
You can't see what James's eyes just did if you're reading this in the magazine or if you're listening to this on the podcast. But James, your eyes went really funny when you said that. I don't know if you're aware that you do that.
Do you not know? He loves saying that phrase.
Rurapente. No.
He says it all the time.
Yes. The penal asteroid of Rurapente. But that whole trial sequence is fantastic when Plummer's going, "Don't wait for the translation!" And you've got Worf, Michael Dorn returns as Worf's ancestor as their kind of defense counsel. It's a fantastic set piece, but there's so much texture to this. You've got the whodunit on the ship, you know, who's responsible for the murders on the ship.
It's a conspiracy thriller.
It's a conspiracy thriller in space.
Good. I mean, it's like Wrath of Khan's great because it's an old school naval, you know, adventure in space. And Star Trek VI is a conspiracy thriller. Yeah.
And Samantha from Sex and the City, it turns out, is guilty. And, you know, nobody saw that coming.
And Christian Slater has the most bizarre and random cameo.
Yes, I love that. Yeah,
he just pops up in a scene for no reason.
I have it in my head. Wasn't his mother like the casting director? It's a familial connection.
But
there.
He wanted to be in it. Like, he is a Trek fan. Mm. It was genuine. It was his choice.
Because he just wakes him up.
Yeah.
He wakes up Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
And you don't even see his face. It's brilliant.
That's right.
What a cast. And Iman as well.
Yes, Iman. Yeah. I mean, like, cast for type as a sexy alien. I mean, the woman was married to Bowie. She's not even trying to hide the fact that she's a sexy alien.
There is an issue there because she's a shapeshifter slash changeling before they introduced shapeshifter slash changelings, and everyone acts as if the founders in Deep Space Nine are this mythical thing that no one's ever heard of, and yet apparently not, because no one bats an eyelid when they see a changeling on Ruripente. So just saying, retcon consistency.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what everyone was thinking about that role.
Yeah. Going back to the continuity, I mean, what I love about Star Trek VI as well is it's the bridge between the Next Generation and the original series, because it presents the event that caused the peace, you know, caused peace with the Klingons and enabled Worf, who we mentioned earlier, you know, to be on the Enterprise for the Next Generation. But, and again, what you're saying about the intelligence of it, it's the analogy for Glasnost, isn't
yes,
it? It's
yeah,
the end of the Cold
so.
War.
Yeah.
The Klingons were always the USSR, you know, in terms of the metaphor of, you know, the universe. And
sometimes and dodgy metaphor of the universe.
It doesn't always.
But yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm not saying it's, you know, ethically or ethically sound or entirely consistent. But that's what's really interesting, and the fact that Kirk is quite antagonistic at the start of the story as well, and it's his journey. He has to come round, and he has to accept that he has to give up all his hatred, and he has to give up, throw out all his baggage for the sake of the greater good.
Note to self, Romulan ale, never to be served at diplomatic functions.
So useful. Such a good... But it is also a film about consequences, like Wrath of Khan again. They're both films about your past returning to haunt you and the sometimes morally questionable decisions that you made in the heat of a moment when you didn't have much choice, maybe, or when you did, but you just did them anyway. You know, the repercussions of that coming back and biting you in the behind.
Both films, of course, written and directed by Nicholas Meyer.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he is the star of Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
He's a massive Shakespeare fan, which is why there are loads of Shakespeare references in both films.
But they do sound best in the original Klingon.
He's right. Bones when Plummer is going, "Cry havoc and let's slip the dogs of war." And Bones is going, "I'd pay real money for him to shut up."
That's from Julius Caesar, right? Which is a play surprisingly full of great lines. Of course, the title comes from the "to be or not to be" speech.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
Well, no, like you think of Hamlet, Macbeth. I don't always think of Julius Caesar on the same level, but it's got so many like just amazing lines in it.
Yes, infamy. They've all got an infamy, and who, of course, can forget when Caesar says, "Never rub another man's rhubarb." Great moments in Shakespeare history.
Okay.
Is that not a line?
Maybe it is.
Okay.
I don't remember the whole play.
So Nicholas Meyer directed the two best original cast Star Trek films. I think we can all agree on that. And then let's move imperceptibly into the next gen movies. And of course, they had their cake and ate it a little bit with Generations, where Kirk turns up and then pops off, shuffles off this mortal coil. What do we think of the Star Trek Next Gen movies? Four of them, and I would say that only one of them is an unqualified, unfarnished triumph.
Yes.
Which one would you say? Oh, First Contact, okay. Yeah.
The thing with Next Gen, my affection, as I think Dan's is for Next Gen over original series, and always will be, just because it's of that period in my life, and it's the one that I grew up loving. Also, it's better. So I have a real affection for all the Next Gen films, but Generations is not a great film.
No,
it's problematic.
Not.
The plot isn't great, and it just doesn't really fit together. And the send-off for Kirk is, frankly, underwhelming as well. But they really rallied with First Contact, and I think using the Borg and using them well was a great idea. Bringing it back to Zefram Cochrane, First Contact with the Vulcans was an interesting idea. Having the Borg try and take over Earth back then, the introduction of the Borg sphere, the introduction of the Borg Queen, which Voyager would then go on to make a massive meal out of and, you know, ruin slightly.
I mean, the Borg Queen always slightly stuck out for me because I'm like, no, they're a collective, there shouldn't be a queen. But I suppose it makes it handy to have one person to talk to.
You kind of need to have a face on the antagonist face, don't you? Alex Krieger's as good a face as
I mean, it was a great face, yeah. don't get me wrong, but yeah, it always sort of struck me as slightly inconsistent.
Well, the mythology means there's not just one queen. It becomes slightly problematic. Like, there are multiple queens, but then I think they share the same consciousness. It's slightly unclear.
Oh, there's a lot of that in, like, sci-fi, isn't there? Yeah. Like, Tyra and the Hive series and all those,
I was just going to say, what an entrance.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Lowered down just a torso into that body. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Not even torso, like a classical bust.
Yeah, with a dangling spinal column.
Yeah.
But First Contact, of course, I think it works because it's a great character piece. You got a lot of humor as well with traveling back in time, which the voyage home mind. But this is less obvious and on the nose and cringeworthy, I'd say, with the attempts at humor than the voyage home. And it's intriguing, of course, there's Jonathan Frakes directing this, and there's a long tradition in the Star Trek films of cast members directing. Leonard Nimoy directed 3 and 4, and Shatner shat the bed with 5. And David Carson, who was a director on the Next Gen show, I believe, was stepped up to play for Generations and didn't do that well. So Frakes grabbed his chance with 8, with First Contact, and did very, very well.
Yeah, he's a good director.
The Picard stuff is what I like the most. It's the difficulty he has having been a Borg. That kind of breakdown, the kind of this far and no further, and you broke your little ship.
But again, that goes back, that's almost an element from echoing Undiscovered Country in the same way that the time travel echoes Voyage Home. It's a deliberate, I think, attempt to kind of reset a little bit and pick, you know, remind people what you love about Star Trek, I think, in this these films.
And I think the Moby Dick references come back, don't they?
A little bit, yeah.
For First Contact.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing that at the cinema. It was, and the audience was really hyped. I remember cheering when Worf turned up.
Yeah,
of course. They're being attacked, and this other ship flies in and blasts them. And then it's Worf with, "Today would be a good day to die." And, you know, it made me think, maybe this isn't as nerdy as I thought it was. These all seem like quite normal people, and they're cheering Worf.
Trekkers are hidden in surprising places.
Who wouldn't cheer Worf?
That was one of the biggest films box office wise, wasn't it? First Contact, not the biggest, because I think that was 4 until the JJ one came along.
Yeah. But then
I think after 4, it was First Contact.
4, if we're absolutely honest, isn't really a Star Trek film, is it?
Do you remember that? Like, you would make a joke about when someone said, "Oh, I know what the sequel to Star Wars is going to be," in your playground, and a kid would go, "What is it? What is it? Oh, they all come to Earth." You know, like, "Oh, Luke and Leia and Chewie are going to come to Earth." And
we can't, because it was a long time ago.
No, I know, so but that was the stupid joke. But that's what Star Trek did. It's like, it's the one where they all come to Earth and walk around and have amusing incidences where they assault,
gonna star
assault
Eddie
poor
Murphy
punks.
As well.
What?
Eddie Murphy was going to be the person that they met. But he didn't want to do it. He wanted to be an alien, and they wanted him to be a human, and so he refused to take part. But
wow!
It was originally an Eddie Murphy vehicle.
Okay, instead it was a whale.
Instead it was a whale. Okay. Yes, that's right.
The original plot was this probe is coming back, and it's distressed that Eddie Murphy is no longer on Earth, so they have to go back in time and get Eddie Murphy.
It's seen Norbert.
Yes,
it's seen Norbert, and then wants to stop it.
Yeah. But I don't mind the Voyage Home. It's very fun. It's very light. It's very frothy. Again, the characters are fun and they're having fun with each other. And so, you know, it may not be the deepest character work. It really isn't the deepest character work. But I just quite enjoyed seeing them all just have a laugh. It's the same way that I really want to see an Avengers film where they just sit around and shoot the shit for 2 hours. It feels like that a little bit, you know.
It's an interesting tonal shift from 3, which is quite intense and quite dark. But obviously, you know, Kirk's son dies in that. And there's a fair bit of wailing and the whole stuff with the Spock and Bones. That's a bit dark as well. Yeah. So it was a bit of a course correction. Now, this franchise is just tonally all over the shop.
Yeah.
Throughout its history.
I mean, so is James Bond. So are a lot of franchises.
That's true. Yeah. So so Voyage Home is, in many ways, what would you say? It's the Octopussy of the of the franchise.
Well,
you know, Diamonds Are Forever. It's a bit more tongue in cheek. A bit more knowing.
I would say it's one of two that are played primarily for laughs, because Insurrection is also a comedy, and I really enjoy it because it riffs on a lot of more playful elements that Star Trek brings. You know, all the stuff with Worf going through a kind of belated puberty. I mean, there's so much fun to it before you get into F. Murray Abraham sort of flying around and having facelifts. But but they do, you know, they have a lot of laughs with that one. And I think if you love these characters, if you live with these characters, it's really enjoyable, flawed as it is as a film.
Insurrection, Beyond, and Voyage Home are the ones that feel to me like they're almost extended episodes.
Yeah, very much.
It almost feels like, oh, this is, what are they doing this week? Yeah. Oh, they're going down to Earth to save the whales. Oh, okay, well, what are they doing?
A Voyage Home was literally done on Star Trek Voyager. Sarah Silverman was in it, where they end up going back in time to LA.
Right.
So they end up doing it again.
But, like I said earlier, Voyage Home is like the end of a trilogy as well. I mean, there's elements in that story which are coming straight out of Search for Spock.
Because
Spock isn't himself yet.
No.
He's still recovering. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of got... That makes it more interesting to me because, you've got all the kind of the silly stuff, but there is a continuation. This Spock's journey, his road to recovery is happening there.
They're literally not on the Enterprise. They're on the Klingon ship from the end of three.
The Bounty. Yeah.
The Bounty.
The Next Gen movies have one undeniable stinker, and that is Nemesis.
See, I quite like Nemesis.
No, not at all. Nemesis is solid. Awful. I actually watched it again recently. Mm. Again, I can see objectively taken as a sort of a film independent of Star Trek where people can kind of find issues with it. But I think Nemesis is a really solid entry. I remember interviewing Stuart Baird for that, and he was really like, he was very like nervy about it. And he said to me at the end of the interview, he said, do you think it'll do well? And I was like, it'll clean up on DVD.
Oh my God.
Backhanded compliments. I don't think he was comforted by that, but it's true. No, it's good.
Nemesis is maligned.
It's the most underrated.
It's not Tom Hardy's finest work, but nevertheless, as Praetor Shinzon, I enjoyed him. I like the introduction of the Remans. There's a lot of fan service in there. The set design of the ship, like the scimitar, is fantastic. But also, it's the first time they'd done the Enterprise on a gimbal, so they actually moved and tilted it, so you didn't have to have that weird thing where they'd wobble the camera and everyone pretend to be falling over. Like, had a real sort of like a realism to it.
So it's not a stinker.
It's not a stinker at all. No, it's, I mean, it is objectively better than Insurrection.
Because I remember it being very, very bad. For me, it's again going back to the Robert Wise thing. It's a director who has no connection to Trek and maybe it's just a bit of a journeyman director and doesn't really know what to do with it. A bit of a Martin Campbell and Green Lantern situation.
Yeah, I don't think he was a fan, but I think he did. He made a really good effort with that one, and it has a lot of emotional punch to it. You know, what happens with Data. You know, a lot goes on in that film, and it feels like a really, you know, powerful capstone to the kind of Next Gen movies.
It just doesn't feel to me like the send off the Next Gen cast deserved.
It's not the send off to the Next Gen cast that The Undiscovered Country was to the original cast, especially right down to the very ending of that film, which is beautiful. The Peter Pan reference. But no, I came out of that feeling very fulfilled. I was happy at the end of Nemesis. I thought, this is the last film, then I'm, you know.
Yeah, okay, it's definitely not The Undiscovered Country, but it's at least got some scope and some drama and some excitement and you know, I think it's maligned. I really do.
Perhaps I stand corrected.
It did really annoy my mother-in-law.
Stand uncorrected.
Yeah, no, she was very annoyed by Nemesis because it killed Data. She said that didn't need to happen. Why did that happen?
It contravened the Data Protection Act.
Yeah. Very good. The only thing that annoyed my mother-in-law more than the death of Data was the death of Wash.
Serenity. Yeah.
Speaking of things,
I'm a leaf on the wind.
Yeah. Speaking of things I'll never get over.
God. Well, this is now a Serenity spoiler special. So apologies if you haven't seen Serenity, but Alan Tudyk gets killed in horrible fashion at the end.
And he's not the only one.
Yes, I thought they were going to kill everyone towards the end.
That's why he did it.
They kill Book, then they kill Wash, and you think that's it, they're all going to die.
Yeah, because at that point he starts putting everyone in like dire mortal peril.
It's like Blake Seven.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, precisely.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was an episode to watch when you were a kid.
I know, right?
Oh, this is... What? What's happening? Oh, my God! You can't do that. They're going to come back next week, aren't they, Daddy?
I still remember the end of the first series of Robin of Sherwood when they killed Robin Hood. And you're just like, oh, my God!
I don't remember that. Yeah, really?
Michael Praed. He wasn't in anymore. And then he was replaced by Jason Connery.
I thought they just replaced him. I thought it was just like he has a different face.
He gets arrowed in the face many times.
Yeah, it has this whole thing traumatic. About Robin Hood is a mantle, not you know, and that's it. Herne the Hunter finds a new person to be Robin Hood and everything.
Because he changes his name because he's just Robin of Locksley, isn't he? In the second one, he's also blonde.
I did not know that. Anyway, so should we get back to talking about Star Trek?
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the continuation
the
movies.
The alternate timeline.
The alternate Kelvin timeline. So Chris Pine and all that jazz. What do we think of these movies? I think they're, out of the three, they're two stone cold belters for me.
They are more than anything else, accessible, which is what Star Trek has never been, apart from The Voyage Home, which is the reason The Voyage Home's box office was always the highest, because it had crossover appeal. And I think this, I mean, it's not Star Wars, but it brought Star Trek out of that really sort of nerdy niche, oh my God, I can't believe you're watching this area, which I live in, to where normal humans could enjoy it. And I think that, if nothing else, is what it's achieved.
I'd agree with that, but also note that it's the first one, and this is where I think that's the two sequels slightly lose points for me. The first one also really nerdily layers it up for fans. So what the first one does, it's like Inside Out, in that fans are watching a completely different film to the ones that non-fans are watching. And I think that's really, really clever, because it does give you an out where you don't have to sit there the whole film going, oh my God, this is wrong. Oh my God, that contravenes what we learned about the timeline in episode X. You know, it gives you a way of say of genuinely rebooting or recontinuing the story from a new point of view. And I thought that was so fiendishly clever the first time I watched it. I was really impressed.
Yeah, I love the way that they baked into the story the whole Kobayashi Maru thing.
Yeah.
Which obviously is referred to way back in Wrath of Khan. And the idea that Kirk was the only person to pass the test by cheating. So what they do is they cheat. They cheat the franchise. The only way that they can continue things on without having to retcon everything or mess everything around is, they, you know, Aoki and Kurtzman and Abrams pull their own Kobayashi Maru. With that film. And I just love that. I mean, it's just really smart. And okay, it's got great big plot holes and stuff like that. But I just remember watching it and just going, this is both fun and also clever.
Yeah.
Like me.
Also very, very Star Trek. To alter the timeline is the most Star Trek
thing. It is the most Star Trek thing.
Yeah. Loved it.
But, you know, it's a whole other timeline now.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
It was such a shame, though, to go from such an assured kind of resurrection of Star Trek to go from that to Into Darkness.
Yes.
Which, exactly, as Helen was saying, it undid all the goodwill they'd earned with that one, which was both accessible but true to Star Trek's history. And then in this one, it's like they kind of unzipped and took a massive piss all over everything that, you know, meant so much to people. The Khan thing, everyone's, I mean, you can John Harrison as much as you like, but everyone knew who that was. And even if they hadn't, no one would have wanted to know that.
Yeah.
Why make it a secret? Why not make like it an whole, asset?
Like the Blofeld thing in Spectre makes no sense.
Yeah, exactly. Use it. Just say that's what's happening. That will get people excited.
Because you get that point where Cumberbatch, who's the best thing about that film, I think. I mean, I really like the chemistry of the reboot cast. I think they're fantastic together.
Yeah,
Cumberbatch is genuinely great in that film. But the bit where he goes, "My name is Khan Noonien Singh," and it means nothing to Kirk, so it doesn't matter. Just reveal it. It's fine.
But then talking about cheating in the first film in a good way, they kind of cheat in a bad way in the second one by having Spock. You know, from the other timeline, because this isn't a reboot. Remember, it's Prime actually technically Spock. A sequel. Prime Spock appears and goes, ah, well, you see, you've got to understand this about this guy because he did this and did it. And it's like the clumsiest bit of exposition ever.
Yeah.
If
you want to go back, you can listen to the Star Trek Into Darkness spoiler special with the producer, Brian Burke, and the writers, Roberto Orsi and Alex Kurtzman, if you want to. And you can probably hear our opinions being completely different in that podcast than they are now.
Yeah.
I think we liked it a little more back then, didn't we?
But as I was saying before, you can hate on it for that, and you should hate on it for that. But it's still, you know, there's lots to like about that.
Yeah, but there's also, like, hiding people in torpedoes, which was just dumb at any age. No, I don't care.
And Peter Weller has a really cool ship.
Sure.
But isn't it the wrong story? That film tells the wrong story. The story that film should be telling is about the Klingon War, right? It's about the outbreak of... which ended up being, of course, the Discovery story, which was a great story.
The Klingons in that look really cool, and they're in it for all of 5 minutes, and it's a real shame.
Yeah, because they pop up for a bit, and you're like, I'm like, oh, brilliant. We're going to see the you know, we didn't call it that then, but we're going to see the Kelvin Klingons, if you like. And, you know, and then this will be really cool. I remember thinking, oh, actually, no, okay, this is going to be really good. And then after that one little set piece... that was it. And then the whole thing was about avoiding the war or something.
Yeah, the militarization of Starfleet and keeping Starfleet true to its ideals.
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, that wasn't delivered well either. And, you know, you have Kirk and Spock still with so much tension between them that the idea that they are also devoted to each other doesn't come across. Like, it's just, it's messy. It's really messy.
I mean, we talk so often on the podcast about how franchises are trying to copy the Marvel model and get it wrong, and they run before they can walk. And Into Darkness is definitely an example of a franchise running before it could walk. And that led to, again, a bit of a course correction with Beyond, where they brought in a new director, Justin Lin. J.J. Abrams was off in a galaxy far, far away. And so they brought in Justin Lin, and he didn't Fast and Furious it up, but he did bring a real sense of fun and a real sense of joie de vivre to it, and focused on the characters. And one of the things I love about Beyond is that it gave Carl Urban something to do, because he is brilliant.
He's fantastic.
Yeah. And he was underused in both previous ones. Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, if you can hear like a noise, there's pipes in the background. We're not doing this in a studio. We're doing this in a meeting room. So there's some pipes we can't control making noise. So apologies for that.
It's the Jeffrey's tubes.
Yeah, it is.
Solid. Love it.
So what do we... So before we bring this home...
I think you mean the turbo lifts, because the Jeffrey's tubes are, of course...
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God.
Oh, Jesus. His eyes did that thing again.
Shut up, Data.
I think he's closer to Lore.
good reference.
That was very good.
Very good. Okay.
See, I don't come to play. I'm so out of my depth. I don't know anything about Star Trek. Quick Google, Lore. Yes, Lore. Before we get into voting, let's very, very quickly go through the best villain for you from all 13 films. Who's the best villain?
Khan.
Yeah, you kind of... I mean, it'd be... I don't know. I love Chang a lot. Mm. So it would be one of those two. Mm-hmm. Ricardo Montalban's Khan, obviously.
He's amazing.
But I mean, I really like Chang. And then, you know, the Borg Queen I enjoy, but I don't think she's on the same level. Mm-hmm. So I'll say, if Helen's going Khan, I'll go Chang.
Wrath of Khan is probably the most quotable movie, isn't it? It's certainly the one that gets the most outings in the Empire office.
It is.
I'm not saying he's the best villain, but we've not mentioned him. But Christopher Lloyd in the third one.
Yeah.
He's good. I like
him. I really like him as generic third Klingon. He's fantastic.
Oh, come on. Christopher Lloyd can be generic if he tried.
He was first Klingon in that as well. Come on.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Mm. What was his name, Dan?
Kormakloth.
He was very memorable. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, and Idris Elba in Beyond, I can barely remember him.
Yes.
I can remember the twist.
That was
a decent twist.
He was not
good. I thought. But otherwise, you know, buried too much under latex. Yeah. And Eric Bana is a bit bland. I know, I love Eric Bana as well, Helen, but perhaps not in the way you do. But...
I mean, you've slagged off Hulk, and now you've slagged off...
When did I slag off the Hulk?
You slagged off Ang Lee's Hulk earlier.
Oh, God, yeah, this has been one long Bana kicking.
Eric Bana pile on.
A bit of respect for Eric Bana, that when he gets hailed over the comedy, he goes, "Hi, Christopher, I'm Nero."
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
Christopher Lloyd in Star Trek, The Search for Spock, of course, plays... Commander Krug?
Commander what?
Krug? James, you can help me out here.
I can't remember his name. I think it is Krug, yes.
Don't worry, Trekkers have long turned off this podcast in disgust.
He had a little slimy pet thing, didn't he? Like a little puppety thing.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he?
We love a slimy pet.
Best character in across all 13 films?
Worf.
Spock.
Worf.
Worf is great.
I love Worf. Love Worf.
Spock. Which version? Spock Prime. Or?
Yeah. I mean, again, Zachary Quinto is great, but...
Yeah. I would always take Kirk over Spock. I love Shatner's Kirk. God. He was just brilliant.
I think this is something that Kirk doesn't get enough credit for being a nerd.
Yeah.
And Spock doesn't get enough credit for being cool.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the interesting thing about both of them is like... Kirk is the outwardly cool one who's like secretly collects actual real books. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Mm. And plays chess and stuff. And Spock is the outwardly, you know, sciencey dude who secretly like has a way with the ladies. And, you know, I like that dichotomy between them.
Well, in that case, I'm going to say Bones.
Bones is great. Who doesn't love Bones?
I never loved Bones.
Not?
Bones is the Derek Smalls of the band. he's you know, one, you know, Kirk's hot water and Spock's cold and Bones is lukewarm.
I mean, he has more flesh on his bones than, for example, Scotty, who's incredibly two-dimensional. But I don't know. He was never... I know he was one of the core three, but he never did it for me.
You know who I liked? I was really disappointed when she didn't come back for three. The character came back, but the actor didn't. Mr. Savick.
Mr. Savick.
Kirstie Alley.
Yeah.
Robin Curtis, I believe, in 3. Someone's probably got that wrong. I could Google it, but I won't. Robin Curtis in Star Trek, the Search for Spock. But Savick was so great in Wrath of Khan. And I always had the sense that there was maybe some a little spark there between her and Spock, well, even though he was many, many decades her senior.
I'm telling you, Spock's got it with the ladies.
Yeah. Well.
Well, look at the JJ film.
Exactly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true.
Also, Data. I want to give a shout out to Data. I always love Data as well.
I mean, I will never say a bad word against anyone in the Next Generation except for Wesley Crusher. and Dr. Pulaski, if
hey,
I'm honest with
I
you.
Had,
Not
I,
a fan of Dr.
Oh, Dr. Pulaski.
Pulaski
was terrible. But I had a crush on Wesley Crusher as a 10-year-old or whatever
really?
It was.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember the episode, I think it's called The Game, whatever. It's the
yes,
one
where he saves the ship.
That's right, where Ashley Judd is in it. Yes. And it's a Wesley Crusher episode. Him and Ashley Judd are having some fun.
He saved the ship more than a 13-year-old should have to.
That he
I'm
did.
Just saying.
Yeah, he did.
I will. I mean, you know, it's the joke argument, but I would argue Picard over Kirk.
Yeah, and you'd be right.
As a character.
Yeah, Picard is. Yeah. Yeah. Picard
in
is,
terms of captains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Picard is godly.
And it's a shame that we never got a Deep Space Nine film, or that would be an entirely
different conversation.
Cisco was a total dude.
You see, Deep Space Nine is the massive hole in my Trek knowledge because I never watched it. Because I by the time that came along, I think I was at the cooler end of my teens. If you see what I mean, I'm not saying I'm not saying I was cooler, but you were more worried about doing the cool things, yeah. Which is why I stopped playing Dungeons and Dragons and stopped watching Star Trek and went out and drunk booze and hung out with girls.
I'm going to go on record right now and say Deep Space Nine is the single best of all the Trek series.
That is correct.
So to have missed it means you missed out massively.
And it's also the coolest.
I mean, it is the coolest. It
was apart
the
from maybe Discovery.
I mean, yeah, Discovery's edgier in darker, probably. But it went to some pretty bleak places. And it was art-based, which none of the others were. Like, it had an ongoing narrative with the Dominion. It was fantastic.
Well, of course, that was forced by Babylon 5. I'm just saying.
I mean, yes, you're right. Straczynski had a massive influence on it. Yeah. But it was it's so, so good.
You all right there, Chris?
If you want to hear James already going on the record about Deep Space Nine being the best Star Trek series, you can, of course, search out our 50th anniversary Star Trek Celebration podcast,
which
Helen and James get really deeply nerdy, and I try desperately to hang on to the coattails. So check that one out. And then the last thing before we vote is the standout moment of the saga, all 13 films. I'm going to go, obviously, for the tragic death, as I said before, of Peter Preston. he served, he lived, he died.
It's a bit when Spock dies while quoting Jeremy Corbyn. I think that's a great moment.
What's he do?
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one.
Or the one. Do you know what I love about that is that they did then twist it for Trek 3, and that's why I think Search for Spock is up there as a good film, because it carries through the, it proves the opposite of 2 and proves the balance for that, which I think is great. But yeah, at the risk of being a basic bitch, I mean, it's the death of Spock. I genuinely, like, to this day, cannot watch it or talk about it for any length of time without tearing up.
It's a gorgeous,
it
gorgeous
is
moment.
So perfectly delivered from Spock to Camley leaving the bridge to Scotty too solemnly saying, you better get down here, Captain, to Kirk looking around, to the race through the ship, to all of engineering just standing there.
It's all right, Helen. It's all right. It's okay.
Helen is legitimately tearing up. Yeah.
I would make a case for another death scene, and that would be the death of Kirk's dad.
Oh, that's a good one, though.
And that's Hemsworth, of course, as we mentioned earlier. And I couldn't believe that the opening of a film introducing a character that we'd only just met.
Yeah.
And the way they shot that, wrote that, the way Hemsworth played it.
Yep.
I was actually like tearing up, and it was the beginning of the film. It's like the first five, ten minutes of the film, and you were already like, whoa. Yeah.
It's one of only two films that ever made me cry before the credits, along with Finding Nemo.
Yeah. Oh, not up.
Oh, it's after the credits.
Oh, is it? Oh, fine. Okay. All right, I'll let you off. but yes, that is very powerful. Surprisingly, so.
Yeah, that's one of the great star-making performances. Mm. That's one of those things where someone who goes in, you have 5 minutes of screen time, grab it and do everything you can with it. And I just hope that guy goes on to do something else, whoever that is. Is it Luke Hemsworth?
Liam
Hemsworth, yeah. Whoever
Larry
that guy
possibly.
Is. Larry Hemsworth.
his brother was really good in those Divergent films.
But he's so good. But yeah, the Spock moment is just, it's a goosebumps moment. It's chills. It's, people often shit on Shatner's ability as an actor. And it's something I've never really understood. If you want to know how good William Shatner is as an actor, watch any of the Columbo episodes where he's the bad guy, obviously. But
or any of Boston Legal.
Or any of Boston Legal. He is so good, but he's so good in that moment. Him and Nimoy together are just extraordinary. It's, you know, and it's so quotable, as James just said. And it leads, of course, I think to Shatner's best moment, which is the funeral, you know, of all the souls I've encountered in my travels.
His was the most...
I love it when he calls Spock. He says, you know what, Spock, we're all human. He's like, I find that remark insulting.
Yeah, I always thought Spock is not necessarily going to be impressed by that eulogy, but still, it's perfect.
That is a fantastic... But there's so many great moments in that film, from him bellowing Khan, you know,
oh my god,
to, you know, the shields when they ambush them in the ships, and like when they go into the nebula and he starts spouting off Moby Dick, I'll chase him round the Antares nebula. I mean, it's so good.
From hell's heart, I stab at thee.
Yes. It's amazing.
I had a really disheartening experience with Wrath of Khan though, because in the magazine, as I'm sure everyone knows, we do this Kids Watch Classics column. And I thought, I know, I'm going to watch Wrath of Khan with my son Louis. And Chris was well up for this, doing that one. And we'll watch that, because if you only see one Star Trek movie, you should watch that one. So I thought, oh, my son. And we were watching it. And we were like, you know, at the beginning. And I was kind of like, he was like, who are these people? What are they talking about? Like, you've got like Kirk and Spock kind of catching, I know everything. And, you know, they're all, and it's like, if you know Star Trek, it means a lot to you. But if you're coming in cold as an 11-year-old, you're like, oh, what's going on? This film's really boring. It's just loads of people and they're talking about it. I don't know what they're talking about. And then I went, look, don't worry. When we get to the spaceship battles, it'll be really cool. And we've got spaceship battles and he was just sitting there like, oh, this is so dull. I can't believe. Oh. And he actually got really upset that because he just got home from school and I thought it was a treat and he felt like he'd wasted. Yeah. He's like, I can't believe I've wasted my downtime watching this film. And I'm just like, okay,
but
fine.
You've kind of tied into there. That's what it has, that Into Darkness didn't have. It has earned everything that happens in it. The fact that it's Chekhov who gets the little parasite in his ear, you know, there's so much weight to that. And if you don't know who these people are, you're just like, meh.
But that's the thing, I didn't know who they were when I watched it. I watched, you know, when I first saw Wrath of Khan, I must have seen, I'd seen some episodes of the original series because it was on BBC Two at 6 o'clock weeknights, probably once a week or twice a week, something like that. I would watch them, and I would know who Kirk and Spock and Bones and Chekhov, all those guys were, and Uhura, obviously, getting the pronunciation right. But when I went into Wrath of Khan, I kind of went in fresh. And it's so elegant at catching you up with who these guys are and establishing the relationships, the interpersonal relationships, by the time the end comes. It's just a beautiful moment. And that really surprised me. Yeah. That really surprised me.
I had to keep pausing it to explain things. I said, okay, so that's Captain Kirk. Who's he? Well, he did it to... Okay, who's that guy? That's Spock. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like... It was. I just thought, I shouldn't have to be doing this. So perhaps the film is more flawed than we think it is, or maybe it's just... Mm.
Or maybe, you know, your son is just wrong. I mean, with all due respect to a small...
He loves 12 angry men.
The more likely scenario here, Dan, is that you have failed as a parent.
Yes, that's the conclusion I'm coming to.
And a human being.
Yeah, I tried.
It is sad, though, isn't it, that everyone talks about the death of Spock and no one cares about the death of Kirk. You know, like Generations does a few things right, like the crashing of the Enterprise D is a kind of an interesting moment. In fact, I would say the most heartbreaking part of that film isn't even Kirk's death, it's the destruction of
the ship,
the D.
Yeah.
It's like seeing the Galaxy Class Enterprise on the planet smash. You're like, I love that ship. And it's Kirk's dead, you know. Yeah.
Who doesn't love the D?
Yes, Chris. NCC-1701-D, of course, being the serial number of that particular Enterprise.
He knew that.
I know, James.
Just it's also the most beautiful Enterprise, I think. Mm.
Yes, it's very elegant. I like the Sovereign class. I like the E when it appears in First Contact. I do like that one. But then even that is better than the alternate reality D that appears in All Good Things, the series finale, with the third nacelle and the whole...
It's a mess. Yeah.
It's almost like they had a model and they just stuck bits on.
All right, what's going to happen now is we are going to go away, put our top tens together. Dan's already hinted at his number one. Well, he's told us his number one and his number three. We're going to put together our top tens. I'm going to compile a top ten, and then we're going to come back and run down the top ten. Right, enough squabbling. Let's vote. Okay, welcome back after that very, very brief break to the ranking Star Trek. Or is it Star Trek the ranking? I should figure that out one of these days. And we have the official top 10. This is the Empire top 10 of the Star Trek movies in order of quality. Three movies. I think you won't be surprised to know, obviously it's 13 movies. Three didn't make the cut. And you won't be surprised to know those three are Star Trek Into Darkness, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and Star Trek The Motion Picture.
What? I am shocked. Shocked, wow. I say.
I thought someone was going to make a contrarian gambit for one of those, wasn't there?
I would put Into Darkness above Search for Spock. I'm just saying.
Oh, my God.
And you did. Final Frontier, in fact, you were the only person to vote for Into Darkness, and I was the only person to vote for the motion picture. So, which is not very good, but again, we're talking the sliding scale of shitness. It is less not good than the others.
Nonsense.
So let's go. Number 10, just narrowly beating Into Darkness is Insurrection. How do we feel about that?
I just don't feel anything for Insurrection, really.
I have
it's fine.
Boundless affection for that film, but it is not objectively a good film. It has some great lines in it, but it's very flawed. I think this is fair. I can't argue with this.
I barely remember it, to be honest. Yeah. But I remember being disappointed that the title meant nothing. Like, there was no insurrection
in
Insurrection.
Well, they do kind of stage Insurrection, and they rebel against orders, don't they, when they go... But
yeah, not in a big way. Yeah. No more than average.
It seems like possibly the script followed the name. But anyway, it's fun. But as Dan said, it's a substandard fun episode of the show.
It's very forgettable.
At number 9, we have another next gen movie, and that is Generations.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. I would also put that below Nemesis. So yeah. I agree with this voting.
I'd have put it higher. Well, I did put it higher, actually. I did put it higher.
Weirdo.
Yeah. Because I know, but there was just a certain fun of the whole Kirk meets Picard thing.
Yeah.
I mean, just the whole thing, the Nexus and the Christmas and the horses. And it's just like, no.
There was less fun than there should have been in Kirk meeting Picard. About the nicest thing I can say about that film is I liked that it gave Guinan something to do.
Yeah, and it was nice to see her in it. But I mean, who thought it was a good idea to have Lursa and Baytor in the film?
Yeah.
What do you think of them, Chris? You love Lursa and Baytor, don't you?
My favourite of all of those is definitely the one where Tasha Yar gets eaten by LePond.
Ah, yes. Anyway. Skin of Evil.
That was terrifying. Don't even start with that.
She returned, though. She returned as a Romulan.
Yeah.
Did she?
Yeah.
Okay. Number 8, Nemesis.
Yep.
Yeah. That's about right. That's about where it should be. Bottom half of the table, but towards the top of the bottom half.
But do you see what I mean? I mean, you have like 6 or 7 good films, and then you're going Nemesis at number 8.
Like I say, I have a soft spot for Nemesis. Mm. I like the whole Picard meets his younger twisted self thing. I thought that was interesting. Yeah. It's fine. It's good.
And it's Tom Hardy as well.
It's Tom Hardy.
You know, if you want a bit of Tom, you know, if you're a Tom Hardy fan and you fancy, you know, having a curious experience, watch him in that film.
Him in that film with a prosthetic nose, so he looks a little bit more like Patrick Stewart.
But only a little.
Mm. Only a very little.
And also, they had to get rid of Data.
You had to get rid of Data.
Because he was getting too old.
Yeah, it wouldn't have worked. You could already see the Spiner was sagging by this point, and it just wouldn't have worked. And I think Spiner has a co-writing credit on Nemesis, so I think he was partly instrumental in the death of his own character.
Data was past his prime anyway. I think when they gave him his emotion chip, he stopped being Data at that point.
Yeah.
It's like, I appreciate as an actor you probably want some dramatic range, but the whole flat deadpan thing, that's your thing, deal with it.
Hmm.
And remember not to use contractions, which he didn't always.
No.
Story only for Brent Spiner, along with Rick Berman and John Logan. John Logan is responsible, and I mean that word, responsible for the screenplay. Okay, so let's move on to number 7, Star Trek Beyond.
I think that's fair. There's lots of fun things, but it doesn't feel like it moves us forward.
I put Beyond above A Voyage Home on account of the fact that A Voyage Home isn't really a Star Trek film.
You're not really a Star Trek.
I mean, apart from all the Star Trek characters.
No, but it's almost like the holiday special.
Did you think it was Police Academy film? Oh, yeah, so it was like On the Buses.
Yes.
Holiday on the Star Trek.
Yeah, I don't know. I like it, and I recognise it's a good film, and actually it was very important in getting more people into Star Trek, but nevertheless, for pure Trekness, I would take it.
I enjoy things like Transparent Aluminium.
Oh, yes. Yes, that like that fun. A lot. Yeah. And, you know, it has some good lines in it. Better for you, it's better for us, it's better for them.
When your major character is going on holiday, it's usually not a good sign.
That's true,
usually
actually.
Not a good sign.
Sorry, are we talking about Star Trek Beyond? Because they go on holiday to that lovely planet, lovely, don't they?
Oh, yeah, we haven't even discussed Voyage Home. That's coming up.
Beyond. The only thing, I mean, Beyond is really good fun, I think. But this is it, because it sits so apart from everything. It's like I miss that sense of connection with the other films. Mm. So it kind of feels more like it's the Insurrection of that series or that kind of a thing. But also it kind of lost a bit of impact, because how many times have we seen the Enterprise destroyed now?
Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, okay. It still upsets me. So if it's not going to have emotional weight when it happens, then why do it?
But they haven't. So therefore the emotional weight is carried by them and their reaction.
Well,
to
then
the
they don't deliver it.
I thought it worked for me.
Note to all actors in the film.
Yeah.
As an audience member who's you know, kind of, like we said, we saw it in Generations, we saw it in Star Trek III.
It has a great moment, though, where the Beastie Boys come into play. And yes. While I'm not a fan of Kirk's musical choices, that was really, really fun.
It was fantastic. And I, along with Simon Pegg, despair of the marketing department, who chose to use that song as a soundtrack to the trailer for the film, which was...
But that doesn't tip you off that it's going to be used in the film.
No, but
all it does is reestablish a link with Kirk and that song.
You didn't need the link. I think it would have been a nice thing for people if they pick up on that, but you don't need it. Like, okay. It's a really cool moment, and I felt that they took away from that. But anyway, it was great. Enjoyed it. Good.
So that's number 7. Number 6, The Search for Spock.
Absolutely not. Shouldn't even be in the top 10. That'd be ridiculous. You're all idiots.
I think James is massively underestimating The Search for Spock, which I think is...
admittedly. Generic Klingon, what was his name, was very, very good in it.
No, but it's good because it develops the story of Wrath of Khan further. It sort of goes against the whole, as I say, it's suddenly the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many, which is the kind of the compassion and the relationships that, you know, you've built up over 30 years of Trek. I think it's... Yeah, I didn't love it as much nearly as it's one, the ones on either side, but I still think it's underrated.
I agree with Helen, although it wasn't much of a search, was it?
No, he's right there.
No, yeah. No, it wasn't.
He's right where we left him.
Yeah.
he's the last place we thought of looking.
It's like the journey to pick up Spock was not really snappy enough.
It's like when you lose something and your mum says, well, where did you last have it?
Or when you fired him onto the Genesis planet.
Oh, he must be there.
So when you lose your glasses and they're on your head.
Yeah.
Number 5, The Voyage Home. Or as James said, A Voyage Home. Have you seen a different...
The Voyage Home. Did I say A Voyage Home? Yeah. I didn't mean to say that. I do know what it's called.
It's just a bit of silly fun, isn't it? It's just a bit of fun. There's nothing wrong being silly, Terry Jones once said. And so, fine, let's let the Star Trek franchise have it silly.
The bit where Spock swims in the tank and mind melds with a whale is fun.
Also, saving the whales generally is a good thing. We should applaud things that save whales and do a good thing.
I like the idea that an alien probe comes back and it's going to destroy the entire planet because we killed the whales. It's very, you know,
I mean, but it could happen, and quite frankly we'd be in the shit if it does.
It's not like they could have had a recording of a whale somewhere that they could have
played. No, because they were having a conversation with the whales. That's the point.
Maybe they could have faked it. If they can use a universal translator to find out what, you know, all sorts of races do, I'm sure they could have broken down the language of whales. But
they didn't have any live ones to work with.
They could have got Planet Earth. I'm sure they've got a Blu-ray somewhere.
Number 4, The Undiscovered Country.
Yes, although it should be higher.
It should be higher.
What?
Discover Country should be 2 or 3, depending on what day of the week.
That's top 3.
Yeah,
it's top 3.
So I'm not saying everyone should agree with me, but that's top 3. This is ridiculous. I'm walking out.
Go on then. Go on then. See if I care. No, stay. Stay. Oh, he's gone. No, stay. Stay.
I will walk at the end. I'm going to walk out.
You are an essential part of this podcast, Darren. All right. So 4 is The Undiscovered Country. Number 3, First Contact. It was very close.
It's very, very close.
Again, First Contact is my number 2 choice.
I see. Undiscovered Country was my number
1. Yeah, but then first, I was really torn on whether to go Undiscovered Country or First Contact. I did go First Contact. But yeah, I think for me, the top 3 are absolutely Wrath of Khan, First Contact, and Undiscovered Country.
The First Contact is a great fun film. It kind of works really well as an action movie, and it's got, you know, a good threat to it, but it doesn't work on as many levels as Undiscovered Country. Undiscovered Country is layered and smart and
I don't weirdly, even though, you know, like yourself, you know, Next Generation is the Trek I've watched most, I don't have the same emotional connection to First Contact that I do to the Undiscovered Country or Khan.
Number 2, Star Trek.
That's too high for me.
It is too high.
I'm happy with it being 3 or 4.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's absolutely far and away the most entertaining of them all by a country mile. And I include Wrath of Khan in that. One issue I do have is it just being called Star Trek.
What would you have called it?
I would call Star Trek something. Star
Into
Trek,
Kelvin.
Not a reboot.
That would be a marketing decision because yeah. Star Trek stuff, Star Trek films don't tend to make a lot of money in the cinema.
Yeah.
And I guess they want to bring in a new audience. They want to start again. So it made sense in that regard. Because even though it isn't a reboot, they positioned it as a reboot.
Very much so.
And I think that was a shrewd move and it paid off.
Mm-hmm. And then number one, The Wrath of Khan? The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Hooray.
Shock.
Because you can.
Undisputed number one by some distance.
Yes.
Yes.
I Happy? Dispute that.
From hell's heart damn stabs at thee.
Dan! So there we go. The Wrath of Dan has ended this podcast. And that is it for this edition of The Ranking. The longest one yet.
Wow.
Imagine what it's going to be like when we do the MCU.
There's going to be so many arguments.
We're going to be here all bloody week. And then we'll realize that ultimately, of course, it's Age of Ultron. Anyway, so that is it. It is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Dan.
Revenge is a dish best served cold.
Was your toodaloo a
And it is very cold in space.
No.
Okay.
Should it have been a quote?
I'm just saying that Dan has gone straight in with a quote.
Yeah.
But there you go. It's fine. It's fine.
I'm sorry.
It's totally fine. It's goodbye from James.
It is a good day to die, and the day is not yet over.
And it's goodbye from me. Live long and prosper and all that nonsense.
God.
But these guys here, you know, these guys of all the souls I've encountered on my travels, theirs are the most... Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.